Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is keyboardist, composer, and producer Jeff Lorber. First of all, streams and vinyl are way, way up in the first half of 2021. I'm going to give you some figures, and I think they're going to blow your mind. Streams are up in the United States 11% to 555 billion. Yes, that's billion with a B, and that's in the United States alone. Now, vinyl is up way, way more, 108% to be exact, to about 19 million in the first half. That sounds like a lot. It is compared to what it was, but that being said, it's sort of a drop in the bucket compared to what streaming is bringing in. Just to show you where things are going, even CD sales, which have been down in the dumps for quite a while now, they're even up 2% to about 19 million. So think about this now. Vinyl sales and CD sales are exactly the same. Now, if we flip the scale though, album downloads are down by 27% and track sales are down by 21%. It's still 102 million, so there's a lot of people that are still downloading tracks, but it's dropping like a rock. If we look at the top songs, it's really telling us something. The very, very top one for the first 6 months of the year is by Olivia Rodrigo. It's Driver's License, and she got 582 million streams. In fact, all of the top 10 are in the 300 million plus range. So, once again, that illustrates the fact that you really need a lot of streams in order to break into the big time. When people start to complain that they had 100,000 streams and only made $10, well, yeah, it's a drop in the bucket as compared to what some of the top artists are really bringing in. So again, just think about this. The top song is at 582 million over 6 months. On the other hand, the top album is Morgan Wallen's Dangerous, and that only brought in 2.1 million consumption units. What's consumption unit? Well, basically they take 1,500 streams from the album, and that's considered one sale or one consumption unit. So if you look at it, 2.1 million over 6 months isn't that much. Gee, a big album used to do 2.1 million in one day sometimes. The top vinyl album was Taylor Swift's Evermore at 142,000. Once again, this sounds like a lot. In the grand scheme of things, it really isn't. So what are we finding out here? Streams are really big. People can complain about streaming, but there's a lot of money being made. If it's not trickling down, it's mostly because of the middlemen. It's not because of the streaming networks. They're paying out 70 to 80% of what they're bringing in to the copyright holder. So there's a lot of hands out in the middle. And as usual, that's who's making most of the money. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Don't forget about my Music Mixing Primer and 101 Mixing Tricks programs that will help take your mixes to the next level. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Now here's something that I find particularly exciting, just thinking about what it will do for soundproofing. There's a new soundproofing tool, and actually all it is a spring-loaded screw. Doesn't sound like much, but this is actually a big deal. It comes from Malmo University in Sweden. And what it does is it forms a gap of a few millimeters between the stud and the drywall's underside. And then, because it's spring-loaded, it will breathe with the sound waves. The sound waves are dampened. So as a result, it reduces the sound through a wall by 9 dB, which is huge. What this means in the future is just about any place can be a lot quieter, and all you have to do is replace the screws in your drywall. This is what the Royal Swedish Academy of Engineering Sciences did to test this, and they came back verifying these results. The bad part is this is so new, it's only available right now in Sweden, but the good part is there's interest from all over the world in making this a standard product when it comes to soundproofing. So this is really exciting. It's a really small thing, but the sound screw, which is what they're going to call it, I think is going to make a huge difference in not only what happens in recording studios, but also in everyday life as well. My guest this week is Grammy Award-nominated keyboardist, composer, and record producer Jeff Lorber. Jeff has released more than 25 albums during his career, and he's considered one of the pioneers of the modern jazz genre. Many of his songs are featured on the Weather Channel's Local on the 8 segments, and he's contributed tracks to the critically acclaimed PlayStation game Castlevania Symphony of the Night. Jeff has done extensive production and session work for other artists including David Kaz, Eric Benet, and Herb Alpert, and he's excelled working as a remixer. He also owns the state-of-the-art JHL Sound Studios. During the interview, we spoke about the brilliant strategy he used to gain visibility for one of his early albums, the event that got him into engineering, his little-known career in remixing, which includes even a track for U2, and much more. I spoke with Jeff via Zoom from a studio in Pacific Palisades, California. Let's talk about when you first got started and got into the music business back in Philly.
Okay. You know, I grew up in a family where there was a lot of music around. I had two older sisters that were taking piano lessons, and my mom played a lot. She was an accomplished piano player. She played a lot of, romantic kind of music like Debussy and things of that nature, basically classical standards. And I just always liked music, and I wanted to get in on the fun. And I had some cousins, too, that were into music too. When I was growing up, folk music was really big, and I definitely did not like that as much as my cousins did. But I had one cousin that was a jazz drummer, and I used to love to go over to his house, and he'd let me play the drums, and he had a big collection of Blue Note albums. And at the time, John Coltrane was living in Philly and playing quite often in the city. And my cousin used to go here and play. He would always leave the family gatherings to go hear John Coltrane playing downtown somewhere. So I wasn't able to really take part in that, but I heard about it, and my cousin turned me on to some cool music. And I guess when I was about 14 was when I started going out to clubs a little bit. 14 or 15, there was a place called the Electric Factory. Yeah, did you ever go there?
I did, yes.
And I saw Pink Floyd when they first came to the U.S. for the first time there, and I saw The Who, and there was a lot of stuff going on in Philly. And then I moved to Boston to go to Berkeley, and there was really a lot of stuff there. I got to see a lot of, well, especially the Jazz Workshop was the main thing.
Yeah. Well, me too. I'm a Berkeley boy too.
All right.
We're probably there about the same time, I think.
I was there 70 to 73.
Oh, okay. You're before me. I was there 77, 78.
Okay. But yeah, I think I got as much from going to hear bands play at the Jazz Workshop as I did from going to school, just about, because I heard some incredible music. I got to hear Horace Silver and Thelonious Monk. I saw Miles like at least three times in Boston. One time at the Boston Tea Party, which was a rock club.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was touring with Keith Jarrett and Chick Corea in the same band, and Dave Holland and I think Jack DeJohnette were in the band, maybe Aerto possibly. And then when I saw him at the Jazz Workshop, I think it was a little smaller group with Michael Henderson and maybe some of those same guys, but not with Keith Jarrett and Chick. I don't know if they had a keyboard player at that point. I think maybe Gary Bartz was playing the soprano sax at that point. Lived in Boston for 3 years. I was cab driver, red cab in Brookline. And what else happened? One of my classmates was John Scofield. And so I became friends with him, and he sort of turned me onto some stuff that he was listening, in particular, Pat Martino, which I hadn't heard of before. And we sort of played together in a band for a little while. Like another guy that I played with was Greg Hawks, who was an alto player who later became the keyboard player. He took that like one semester mandatory keyboard class that horn players had to take and used that to good effect to join the Cars. So he did okay with that.
I went to Berkeley as a student for a couple of years, and I became a teacher, mostly in the audio department. Completely the audio department, actually. His brother's younger brother was one of my students.
Okay.
Small world.
I guess he didn't get the mandatory keyboard class.
I guess not.
Oh, yeah. Oh, another thing that happened at Berklee. Yeah, I heard one of your shows where you mentioned being in Boston. So I wasn't a good enough, the thing that everybody really looks forward to at Berklee is being in the ensembles. And unfortunately, my reading wasn't quite good enough to make it into the ensembles. So they put me in remedial reading class. And my friend Bobby Columbi is constantly bringing that up, like kind of basically telling me that I'm retarded or something, that I was in remedial reading. But I really was a good student in the remedial reading class. And my reading is much better now.
You went to Portland then, right?
Yeah, I moved to Portland. You know, I just kind of actually, I sort of, I thought maybe the music thing wasn't going to work, but it turned out that Portland was a great city to be in because there was really a lot of places to play and there were a lot of good musicians there. And I actually started my group not because I had any dreams of huge success or anything like that. It was mainly because I was playing with other people who I just thought the band leaders that I was working for were terrible. So I decided to just do it because nobody else was doing it very well. And I started out just doing kind of top 40 commercial stuff, but then I decided to do more of a jazz thing. And we made a little demo tape. I sent it to a couple places, and one was this little label called Inner City Records that was a guy named Irv Kratka who had a business putting out these things called Music Minus One Records that was pretty successful for him. And then he found a couple European labels that he imported, and then he started to sign his own acts. And I was one of his first acts. And the first record did well just based on the local Pacific Northwest scene, because we were doing well there. And there was actually like a one stop in Seattle that decided to make my record sort of a little project. And he actually managed to really help sell that Inner City record to all the stations in, you know, all over the Northwest, because we played in Corvallis and Eugene and Seattle and Missoula, Montana, and, you know, Arcata, California once, I think. You know, so it was just a local Northwest thing. And then we sold enough records so that our second album, we had a little better budget. And I wasn't too crazy about my sax player at the time in terms of the way he was soloing. So I decided to use some of that money to hire Joe Farrell to play sax on the record. And when I informed my sax player that that's what I was doing, he got kind of mad and said, "Why don't you get Chick Corea to play your parts?" And I thought, yeah, that's a good idea. I should try to get Chick on the record too. So I got Chick and Joe Farrell to play on this album. And then because of that, it got a lot of national attention. And I got a couple offers from major labels to sign. We went with Ariston. I ended up making six records over there with Clive Davis at Ariston.
That's awesome. So it's worth hiring the best.
Apparently. Yeah.
That's where you got your engineering chops too, right?
Well, what happened was, I wasn't really planning on having engineering chops, but there was a little, my friend Rick that sort of introduced us. So Rick was working for me at the time as my engineer, and he accidentally erased one of my demos that I was working on. So at that point I decided maybe I better learn how to do this. And so I had a little 24 track board that we used live, but I also used at home to record in an 8-track tape machine. And I was really shocked when I started, like after we got our record deal and I started going down to LA and working in real studios, about how, you know, what I learned from just working at home was, it was like completely the same stuff as using, you know, an SSL or an EU board. It's just the same, you know, you put stuff in record and obviously there's a little bit more to it, but you know, there's EQ and there's compression, and it's like, I felt really at home pretty quickly when I started to use real equipment down in LA. And I was lucky because like the first time I really made a record down there was at Hollywood Sound with a guy named Rick McConan, who had worked with the Crusaders. That's why I hired him, because I was a big fan of the Crusaders albums. And also Earth, Wind & Fire was working on their stuff at the same time. And I think this happens to a lot of people. that when you first get to a real studio that gets a good sound, you sort of, it kind of gets imprinted on your mind that that's the way things should be, because I love the sound of the kind of relatively small drum rooms that studio had, that had this real tight sort of R&B sound. And that's what I have in my studio, basically, you know, similar dimensions and a similar kind of sound. And I think that gives you a real punchy sound that really helps in terms of recording and getting a good drum sound.
I worked with Rick once. I was doing a surround mix. Don't remember what it was, but the artist asked that Rick come in and supervise. So we got a chance to work together and it was fun.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely, like, I don't know, if you listen to those Crusader records, they sound incredible. So, and I think I, for some reason, I might be wrong about this, but I think it was a quad eight board there at Hollywood Sound. And those records sound good. So I think, you know, transistor technology, you know, you can't go wrong.
There's something about Rick, really great engineers just have a touch.
Exactly.
They can make very minute, I noticed this with Al Schmidt as well, they can make very minute changes that actually sound really big. And Rick was like that. I mean, very minute changes. And I was like, oh, that's really good.
Well, also, engineers from that era that grew up, I mean, there was only one way to record, and that was through analog boards onto tape. It wasn't like nowadays you have people that specialize in various things. There's plenty of engineers out there right now that probably have never recorded a drum set in their life. And so so it's just a different thing back then, where, you know, most of the engineers learned, you know, they started out as assistants, and they learned from somebody that knew what they were doing. And yes, it was just a different way of recording. I mean, it's funny that it seems so ancient and in the past, but it wasn't really that long ago in some ways.
So how did your studio come about?
Well, the thing that really, you know, made me want to get a full studio here at the house was, instead of just like a funky demo studio, was for some reason I had like a check come in for something, and I decided I was going to get a Publison. And I went to Westlake, and the Publison was there. But then right next to the Publison was a JH-24 that was going for, I think, $13,000 or $15,000, something like that. And I did some quick math in my head, and I realized that I couldn't afford not to buy that, because at the time I was spending about $20,000 on studio time to make an album for each record I was making. And I figured that if I own my own 24 track and a board, that that I could basically, you know, put that money in my pocket and do a lot more things with it too. And I got a 2600 Soundcraft. Does that sound right? 2400.
2400. Yeah. I had one myself.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah. They were great. I mean, you know, I wouldn't recommend the EQ, a whole lot of the EQs necessarily, but they sounded really good. And in fact, at one point I had two JH-24s, because I, you know, from, let's see, from, I guess about 89 to 93, somewhere in there, not 88 to 93 or 4. I ended up doing a lot of remixes. I ended up getting in with this engineer named Keith Cohen, who is managed by this guy named Sandy Robertson, that maybe you've heard of, who manages a lot of famous producers and engineers. And at that time, it was just like the perfect time for remixes. Like, all we were working mainly for this guy named Lewell Silas at MCA, and we were remixing all of the stuff that he was working on, which was New Edition, Ready for the World, Fine Young Cannibals. And then we ended up doing, and then Jimmy Iovine was working on U2, and he hired us to work on a U2 album. So all of a sudden we started, this didn't last very long, but we started doing some rock stuff, remixes for rock stuff, because our remix for the song Desire, I guess, helped them sell a lot of units on what then was called CHR radio or something like that, some kind of dance top 40 format that all of a sudden they got a lot more airplay from this remix that we did. And so so then we ended up getting hired to do a few of those, but most of the rock acts that we worked for weren't too crazy about remixes. U2 was, though, and amazingly enough, like in my whole experience of doing remixes, and I must have done 100 probably in those years. You know, I never met any of the artists, but U2, for whatever reason, was in town, and they came down when we were remixing the stuff. And Bono got so excited about what we were doing that he actually went into the studio and recorded, because I think the song originally was only 3 minutes long, or maybe not even that, the song Desire. And he decided to come up with a couple more verses, and we were hanging out in the studio. And I don't think the drummer and the bass player, they weren't too crazy about it, because I replaced the bass and I sampled the drums and quantized them. And the other two guys were really excited about it, The Edge and Bono. So so it was fun. It was fun to work with them on that remix.
Yeah, rock guys wouldn't appreciate that. I mean, I was in the same category at the time. It's like, I don't understand the premise behind this. It's already finished. Why would you want to do it again? But on the other hand, so many artists had a lot of success as a result and more visibility. So it was definitely worth it.
Yeah, I think, you know, usually what we would do is we would get the tape and we would listen to it. And if it sounded really good, we would just go straight into doing the remix, which was basically a dance version for the dance club. That's basically what we were there to do. But sometimes we would hear what they had, and then we decided, well, this could be better. So we would actually do a version, like a new sort of 7-inch version with some new additional production. Because basically we would, whatever they had, we would have like another 24 track full of new production, you know, like a new kick drum, new drums, new keyboard parts. We would keep some of the key parts from the original record, whatever they were. Sometimes just the vocal and that's it, sometimes more. But yeah, so at Larrabee we had, you know, 48 tracks to deal with. It was hooked up so that we could use that. And and that was a great studio to work in. And in fact, my studio here is almost a recreation exactly of Larrabee studio B. I don't know if you can see this.
Yeah.
This is a What is it called? 4056? This is a 4056 that I bought from George Martin that used to be at Air Oxford Street. And
wow, very cool.
And I got speakers from George Oxberger, and it's got the exact same, you know, power amps crossover. I got the same chair that they had at Larrabee. I used to have the same floor, but I didn't like the floor. I ended up changing that out because it was too bumpy. And, you know, so it's sort of an exact recreation, and I really like it. I've been here for a while now.
So you've done a lot of production as well as being an artist. Did that just happen naturally?
Well, yeah, I mean, mostly it's for jazzy stuff, or, you know, I mean, I have done some more vocal pop stuff along the way. But I definitely learned from the School of Hard Knocks, where I wasn't lucky enough to have producers on my early albums. Although I had some co-producers, like when I was in Portland, there was a guy named Marlon McLean that was in a band called Pleasure that was signed to Fantasy, and he sort of helped me out with one of the records that I recorded there. But I guess when I really learned more about production in particular was when I went through doing those remixes for all those years, because that was really incredible in terms of, you know, you could really study the production that you would get. And one of our early clients that we worked with a lot was Jam Lewis. And so I think it was Alexander O'Neill and Sherelle and forget what else. But, you know, there was actually a whole Alexander O'Neill remix album that came out from the stuff that we did. I think it was a pretty big hit in the UK. Not sure if it did anything here. But, yeah, like I said, we were working for Lewell and we worked on all their MCA stuff. And then he would get gigs from other labels. He would change his name and call himself LSJ, which is his initials backwards or something. But anyway, yeah, the Jam and Lewis stuff was incredible, because when they, you know, this was earlier in their career and everything was 24 tracks. So they wouldn't print a Rhodes in stereo because the space was too valuable. I guess they would just put it through a chorus or something, you know, when they mixed, if they wanted it to be in stereo. But it just their stuff was just recorded beautifully, and the amount of low end that would come off tape just by pushing up the fader on the bass tracks was just insane. I guess there's something magical about that Harrison board that they used up there that was really fantastic. But yeah, but I learned, and then also being a session musician, I did a lot of sessions for a while. I was pretty popular when it came to MIDI arranging. And so I worked with a lot of people. So, you know, everybody's totally different. Everybody works totally. I mean, they work different, but I mean, everybody's going after making good music. And so there are similarities. And so I guess after learning all that, it just became second nature to want to get into production and to want to be involved in that as an arranger and as a keyboard player. And I play a little guitar. And
yep. But you're coming with the full package though, because you can
exactly.
do all of that. It's most producers are pretty wide ranging in what they can do, but I think you're taking it a little farther than most of them.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I'm a big fan of, you know, there's just so much out there about recording and about the studio and how to get a great sound. And I'm interested in all that. But a lot of times, the way to get a great sound has nothing to do with using a good preamp or EQ. It has to do with just making sure it's got the right bass line and the right drum part. And I think you can do more with arranging than you can with gear sometimes.
Well, if you have something that's well arranged, it mixes itself.
Exactly. Exactly right.
And speaking of which, Space Time. So let's talk about your new album, because I listened to it last night. It's great. Oh,
thanks.
It smokes. It's just, the playing is so good, but the sounds are good too. Congratulations on that.
Well, thanks.
Really good.
Yeah. Yeah. I was lucky. I work with, I do mix some of my own stuff, but you know, I work with Peter Mokrin, who's a great engineer, and we've been working together for a while. And so it's definitely a luxury for me to let him take that responsibility away from me. And he's more of a specialist. But yeah, he did some great mixes. Yeah. You know, to me, like, I start out and I pretty much write stuff on my own. I have a really large collection of Pro Tools sessions that are all organized in terms of beats per minute. And so when I start writing a song, I try to find just some live drums that I can use just to work with as demo drums. And that makes a huge difference right there. Cause like, I just love the sound of live drums. And you can edit them and make sure that the fills go in the right place and all that if you want to spend the time to do that. And, you know, so another thing that I do occasionally is, like, sometimes the kick drum pattern isn't right. So I'll just mute the kick drum and I'll come up with a new kick drum pattern. So that's something else I do. But yeah, so that's sort of one of my secrets that I use to help me really make great demos, I think. And then I have a really great relationship with Gary Novak, who's a terrific studio drummer here in town, and he doesn't live that far away. So, and he's got a drum set up here, and I got some nice C12As I use for overheads, and some, you know, a bunch of API preamps, and that's mostly what I record the drums through. And so that's where everything starts, and that's a really good kind of basis for building everything on, just between what I can do with the keyboards and the synth bass part and the live drums. And, you know, already stuff's sounded pretty solid and pretty great, you know, with a great drummer like that.
One of the things that jumped out to me was how good the snare drum sounded.
That's just those overheads, the C12A. Did I say that?
C12A, yeah. Yeah.
Right. Not C12s, but C.
Yeah.
They're not quite that expensive.
Still hard to find.
They're hard to find?
They're still hard to find, yeah. C12A.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had trouble because they do need repair on occasion. But I actually have five of them.
Oh, look at you.
I have two for my piano and two for the overheads, and I got one for a spare. That's important.
Yeah.
Although ever since I got the spare, they haven't been breaking as much for some reason. Yeah. And usually they just need like that new Vistor thing replaced. That's pretty much it. Whatever that is. Is that considered a real tube or what? What is, it's so small.
It's a hybrid, I think, of some sort. But whatever the case, you seem to favor the Rhodes above everything else. Was that always like your instrument, or am I wrong on this?
Well, I play the piano a lot. I mean, the thing that's so cool about the Rhodes is that from a rhythmic standpoint, compared to a piano, when you come off of it, it mutes it. So it's a little more of a rhythmic instrument, and But, you know, I don't really, and I have a couple of them here, and I have a really nice one that in particular that I do most of the recording with that I got from Herb Alpert a long time ago. And it's one of the more modern Rhodes. It's very bright. Oh, and it's Eddie Reynolds. It's a guy that's kind of well known for modding Rhodes back in, I guess, the 80s. And but I feel like both of them are really important. Like those are my two like main axes, and the Mini Moog, you know, comes in third place. Not for bass though. I use the Mini Moog for bass all the time, and I play guitar too. But I'm not. I mean, I'm not great, but I can put down some basic stuff. So I have really a lot of fun playing guitar. Actually, really, I'm really into it.
Getting back to the album, I guess you recorded it all apart then, right? Because you did it during the pandemic.
Right. Well, you know, yeah, that's usually the way we're doing things here. Once in a while, we'll get a rhythm section in here. Like the record that I made before this one was with Mike Stern, and he was pretty adamant about recording his stuff with the band. We had Dave Weckl in here, which you can imagine he's pretty particular about his drum sounds. So that was a lot of pressure. Trying to play and engineer at the same time.
Yeah.
On that one, that was a tough one. And Jimmy Haslip. But yeah, I just find doing my thing where I use the live drums as demo drums and then bringing Gary in and then building from there, that works pretty well. And I have some other sort of go-to guys that I really like to use. Like Dave Mann is a fantastic horn arranger in New York, and he's really just an excellent producer and engineer too. So his stuff comes in sounding fantastic. And I prefer to, you know, be in the studio with people if I can though. And Gary, you know, there was no problem with Gary coming over, so that was good.
Was it a hassle to get parts coming from people? Did you supervise them over Zoom or something when they were doing their parts, or did they just do it and send them?
Well, I worked with Mike Landau, who actually lives right in the neighborhood. I mean, he's only like a few blocks away, who I don't normally, I mean, I have worked with him over the years quite a bit, but he's definitely featured on this record. But he was sort of new in terms of, well, I shouldn't say completely new, because I think I have had him send me parts before, but his parts sounded really good. There was a little bit of interaction where I had him, you know, kind of change and fix up a few things, but that was pretty easy. Just, you know, Jimmy Haslip came over and played over here. And another guy who was a big contributor to the record was Bob Mintzer, the sax player. And so the last time I worked with him, he came over, but this time he recorded himself at his place, and that ended up sounding just fine too. So I guess I got lucky, because it doesn't always work when you're counting on people to both produce and engineer themselves as well as be a player. Not everybody can do that.
I know that I certainly can't. I can't produce and engineer at the same time. I can for overdubs, but not for basics. So I was always hire somebody really good.
Yeah. I wish I had done that when I was working with Mike Stern a year ago, whenever that was. Yeah, that seems like a must, because that's a lot to deal with.
Yeah, especially if you have players that are picky about the sound. Too many things to think about.
You know, since then, I had basically, like at that point, I pretty much just had the, you know, the headphone system that comes with the SSL. But since then, I've gotten something new, which is called MyMix by whoever makes it.
Oh, yes, I've seen it.
But now I'm ready for a much better headphone experience where everybody can kind of dial in their own mix. And I haven't had a chance to use it yet, unfortunately, but I'm ready for the next band recording.
Sometimes it doesn't work though, because there are people that to save their lives, they can't dial in a mix, you know, you sort of have to do it for them.
Right. Yeah.
Do you want to speak about PKD?
I can. So I have something called polycystic kidney disease, and it's in my family. And unfortunately my mom had it, and you know, just a lot of people in my family have it. And it's one of these things where usually at a certain age your kidneys stop functioning, and they don't really have anything to address it yet, except for they have kidney transplants, which I was very lucky to get one from my wife, and so that was terrific. And so I think I'm going on 16 years on kidney transplant as of next November. But yeah, so I've been trying to do what I can to let people know about that. And there's an organization called the Polycystic Kidney Foundation in Kansas. And Chuck Loeb and I made an album that's called Bop with a bunch of other people, with Randy Brecker and Rick Braun and Everett Harp and a bunch of other great musicians. And the money that comes in from that, from the streaming, you know, we send it to them. So that's a nice thing. Yeah, so that's basically it. I just try to support them as much as I can.
Last question, Jeff. What's the best piece of business advice that maybe you learned along the way, or maybe someone imparted to you?
I knew you were going to ask me that, because I've been listening to your podcast. You know, I was listening to your podcast a few weeks ago, where you were interviewing Miles Copeland. He was talking about when the Police played this little gig for four people, that it turned out to be a real key thing that really helped boost their career. So I guess my experience is very similar to that, in a way where I was living in Portland, and I was teaching this little jazz improv class. And one of the students said, hey, we have some studio time at a place nearby. You want to come and watch me and my group record some demos at the studio? And it was a 16-track studio called Ripcord Studios in Vancouver, Washington. And I went over there, and the band was having a little trouble getting things together. So I sort of stepped in and helped, you know, come up with some ideas of how to organize the music and tell people what to do a little bit. And after they finished, the engineer came up to me and told me that he thought that it seemed like I knew what I was doing, and he was trying to learn about engineering. And he was wondering if I wanted to get into the studio, and so I could practice making demos and he could practice engineering. The guy's name was Dave Dixon. And that was sort of my big break, in a way, because after that, that's how I was able to make the demos that got me my little deal on Inner City Records, and eventually, you know, sort of allowed me to continue on as a professional musician and do a lot more. So I guess the bottom line to all that is, when you get those lucky breaks like that, you have to be ready to take advantage of the situation. You have had to somehow, you know, just have the talent, or the ability to make the most out of it. So I guess that's basically it. Is good business advice is when you are lucky and you get something that can be a lucky break, just be ready to take advantage of it. And hopefully you've done your homework to be able to do that.
You can find out more about Jeff at lorber.com. That's Lorber, LORBER.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to the episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-in form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.